Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the March 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with the article that I didn't finish last week, that I'm going to finish today with Alice Coltrane. And then an obituary about Soul Brother guitarist Steve Cropper, who passed away in December. And a classic album review of Ray of Light by Madonna. So I begin with the article about Alice Coltrane, and this is titled The Seeker. The death of John Coltrane brought profound psychological and spiritual crisis to his wife and musical confederate, Alice. But it came from her adoption of the harp, followed by music of transcendent beauty. In this extract from his magistral new Alice Coltrane biography, Andy Betta reveals how she stepped into the light. The piano is the sunrise, and the harp is the sunset. And this is where I left off last week. On Easter Sunday, April 14th, Alice Coltrane made her solo debut and staged a concert at Carnegie Hall. She billed it as Cosmic Music and dedicated it to the Cosmic, Beloved Lord. Her group consisted of her old Detroit friend, Joe Henderson, and Pharaoh Sanders on tenor saxophones, Jimmy Garrison on bass, Rashid Ali, and Jack DeJohnette on drums, and Alice on piano and harp, premiering the instrument she taught herself how to play mere months after it first arrived at her doorstep. 2 days before the concert, the first feature story on Alice Coltrane appeared, and she spoke about carrying on her husband's legacy. He said to me just a few days before he died that I should go ahead and do this myself. I've done all the arrangements, but I've followed patterns my husband set. It's really his music. In his final years, Sanders talked about actualizing the music of Coltrane. It was like a communication through music, like he knew some things I wanted to know that he could express musically, and maybe I had some things to contribute to. It's hard to talk about it except in spiritual or religious terms, actually. Whenever he did, he wanted it to come from inside himself, and he did not want to hold anything back or hide anything he found. Good or bad, it had to be expressed. Alice began to put together an album that would be the first release on Coltrane Records. There was a gatefold with a collage she conceived and arranged, The Great Sphinx of Giza. Siddhartha Gautama, a.k.a. the Buddha, Krishna, Jesus, and John in deep concentration, the Sanskrit symbol for Om, the Islamic star and crescent, and the Star of David, all dancing against a star field. The back cover had a photo of John praying before the Peace Memorial in Nagasaki, Japan. For the cover, Alice took me on the many sketches he kept in a notebook, a pattern of swirls like pinwheeling distant stars, and enlarged it for the cover art. Alice Coltrane called it Cosmic Music. The album appeared that summer and caught Impulse completely off guard. Neither Impulse, producer Bob Thiel, nor Impulse's parent company, ABC Records, had any idea that the project was in the works. And now there was another label, Vine, with them on the very popular and lucrative John Coltrane album market. label bosses realized there would be problems if Alice held all the master tapes and started putting out the music herself. But how would it look to have John Coltrane's record label sue his widow within the first year of his passing? Not 2 weeks after Cosmic Music hit the shelves, there was a notice that Impulse had signed Alice to the label as a solo artist. And here's one song off of that album, Cosmic Music, by John Coltrane and Alice Coltrane, called Manifestation. They were very courteous and not in any way forceful or unkind, Alice recalled. They simply said, "Why don't you let us do it? We can take this album you've done, put out Impulse, stamp on it, and let's start from there." So for that short time, I think I learned something, but I was not inspired to have a record company. It was a good experience, though. Now her attention could turn wholly onto her own music. Soon after Cosmic Music, Alice set about manifesting her own vision of this universal sound. Working into the wee hours, she would not fall back on the musical modes she had previously mastered. She would forge ahead. This cosmic music would remain free, metered, and loose in structure, with an open modality that allowed every collaborator to bring themselves forth in the music. Yet, the first pieces she composed and recorded at Dix Hills that summer harkened back to the gospel feel of her earliest memories of playing at Mount Olive Baptist Church in Detroit. That summer, Alice stripped back the sextet for a classic piano trio session featuring Garrison and Riley. The song Gospel Train, with its shaken sleigh bells and Alice's left-handed comping, evokes the feel of a Sunday service call and response. But the music feels slippery. Her piano moves like an initiate mind in meditation, sometimes intensely focused, other times drifting into new realms, high up in the piano register, expanding and contracting with every breath. Here's a little bit of that song, Gospel Train, by Alice Coltrane. Also featured on I Want to See You, Lovely Skyboat, and Oceanic Beloved, her newfound harp style. These six ruminative pieces comprised her debut album, A Monastic Trio, its title suggestive of a Zen Buddhist koan. And here's some of the song Oceanic Beloved by Alice Coltrane. Among friends, neighbors, family members, and others, the perception was that Alice Coltrane experienced a total nervous breakdown in 1968. She refused to eat for days at a time, and her weight plunged to 95 pounds. Hardly sleeping, she wandered the house in such a zombified state that she startled the family dogs. She would meditate for hours upon hours, looking down to hallucinate that her body was on fire, or else realize that she was bleeding, not knowing why or how. For many years, she chose not to discuss those lost months in the wake of John's death. When she finally did, a decade later, it was as a self-published 53-page book. In Monument Eternal, she depicted this time through her own lens. Instead of a nervous breakdown, she described a drastically different internal experience. Using a Sanskrit word, tapasya, a penance, a self-mortification of the body and sense so as to attain higher spiritual goals. As her tapasya receded, Alice Coltrane convened Rashid Ali and bassist Ron Carter for another trio session in Dix Hills. They cut six songs on May 14, 1969, which became Huntington Ashram Monastery. A bit of a joke on the Coltrane home and the purple-carpeted bedroom where Alice was cloistered most of her days. Her linear notes referenced a trio of Hindu spiritual teachers, Paramahansa Yogananda, Swami Chidananda, and Sri Swami Sarvananda. Alice explained that ashram means hermitage and added, "I feel that the real ashram is in your heart." Huntington Ashram Monastery remains the most contemplative album in Alice Coltrane's discography, a fresh reimagining of what the jazz harp piano trio could sound like. On side one, the title track, its foundation, a Piant Astrano pattern from Carter, ripples and plays like hands roving across the surface of a stream, while Turiya, a word that Alice said signified the high state of nirvana, the goal of human life, utilizes her harp dreamlike timbre to induce a sublime state. And here's a little bit of the title track from that album titled Huntington Ashram Monastery by Alice Coltrane. On side two, where the focus is on her bluesy piano style, IHS, a.k.a. I Have Suffered, revealed the profound depths of grief she was still processing. The piano is the sunrise and the harp is the sunset, she explained. All that energy, light, brilliance, and clarity that's in the rising sun, or what we call rising, it's actually us moving over toward the light. You can hear in the piano. Then listen to the sonatas of the harp. Subtleties, the quietness, the peacefulness, that's like our sunsets. but the Son is always a son, and a person is always who he or she will be. Here's part of the song, IHS, or I Have Suffered, by Alice Coltrane. Liner notes, she wrote about meeting Swami Chinnarda, whose name translates as one who is consciousness and bliss, when he lectured in New York. In the midst of her spiritual quest, Alice was still seeking a guru, someone who might cast light and provide some understanding, someone who might guide her and alleviate the anguish she still felt in the wake of John's death. One who had observed Alice's struggles, not only the loss of John, but of her father, mother, and half-brother, Ernie Farrow, in quick succession, was Coltrane's fellow Detroiter, William, later Vishna, Wood. Wood had been seen yoga teacher Swami Sachindara, who preached a message of divine love, universal harmony, and inner freedom out of an Upper West Side apartment and at the nearby Universalist Church. Wood recommended the experience to Alice shortly after Sachidima gave the opening benediction at Woodstock Festival in August 1969. Coltrane became a regular at the Swami's Integral Yogi Institute, IYI. In January 1970, Alice started work on a new album with help from a new producer at Impulse. Ed Michael had got his start producing jazz and blues albums at World Pacific and Riverside Records before moving over to Impulse in 1969. Up until that time, he had only conducted business with Alice over the phone. But on January 26th, Michael rented a station wagon in Manhattan, picked up Pharoah Sanders, Joe Henderson, and Ron Carter before driving everyone out to Dix Hills. After two hushed trio albums, it would mark the first time Alice had recorded with horns since her time with John. Upon arriving at 247 Candleward Path, Ed Michael finally met Alice Coltrane face to face. It wasn't all that unusual to do a quintet album in a single day session, he'd recalled, especially one without involved arrangements. I don't remember how much music was written out. Certainly, it was not a lot. What I principally remembered is the ongoing conversation between Pharoah and Joe, which was about extended-range saxophone technique, since both of them were masters. Four pieces were laid down that winter's day. more focused yet more ambitious than anything Alice Coltrane had previously attempted. The epic title track, Pita, the El Daud, referring the ancient Egyptian god of creation, remains unlike anything in her discography, a sprawling 14-minute march that goes through a vast topography of emotional peaks and valleys. In the liner notes, she described the thrilling contrast of the saxophone styles. Joe Henderson is more on the intellectual side, while Pharaoh is more abstract, more transcendental, she said. Here's a little bit of that song, the title track, Pita, the El Daud, from Alice Coltrane. For Michael, the hardest part about the session was properly recording the harp. The harp has a wider tonal range than the piano, and those damn noisy pedals. She was very clear and specific about corrections in the mix and where she wanted edits. Alice was also becoming more involved with events at Shanimanda IYI. That December, the guru invited her to accompany him to India to attend the World Scientific Yoga Conference. Alice was now part of the Swami's inner sanctum of devotees, contributing not just financially, but musically as well. The actor Sally Satya Kirkland put on a program on the life of Buddha, and I had a chamber orchestra at the time, so I played the music, Alice recalled. Tulsi Reynolds was also part of the program, playing tambura. It was really freeform, she recalled. One day, Alice said, I'm going to be recording, and I'd like you to play the tambura. At Dix Hills, Reynolds joined the group, including Pharaoh Sanders, Rashid Ali, and bassist Cecil McBee, whom Reynolds had gigged with a few times at Cafe Agogo in the West Village. When Pharaoh walked in and he saw a white lady playing tambura, I thought he was going to faint, recounted Reynolds. Alice just looked at him and said, Pharaoh, and he calmed down. Cecil was laughing hysterically because he knew me. I didn't say anything. I just picked up the tambura, and of course, once we started and he saw that I could really play, then he was fine. There may not have been much prepared for journey to Shaktandura in a way of written music, but Alice knew what she wanted. The music would be an expression of gratitude at her newfound relationship with Shaktandura and the hope that it kindled in her heart. The music would contain all the grief and suffering of her journey, as well as the hope and healing that now emerged on the other side of her trials. As McBee recalled of the session, it was very, very spiritual. The lights were low, and she had incense, and there was not much conversation, dictation, or verbalization about what was to be. her desire of your essence was all very, very tangible. Pharaoh had been Alice's closest musical collaborator for almost 5 years, but even he felt apprehension when approaching this ineffable music. Her plan was amazing. I loved what she was doing, but I always felt like what I was doing wasn't good enough, he said. I had told her, I don't know if you like the way I'm playing or not. I don't know whether this fits. She said, you're doing okay. Just keep playing. Keep on blowing. Foundational to the music recorded that day in Dix Hills was the unhurried thrum of Reynolds' tambura. What the tambura does is it sets down a sonic field in which all the other instruments can float, Reynolds said. On the title track, McBee sets up a mythological ostimo, both rooted in Reynolds' drone and spiraling far above it. And when Alice's harp comes in, it's like the gates of Eden swinging wide. This new composition announced Alice Coltrane as an artist in her own right, actualizing what universal sound that her husband strove toward with his later music. While it was not the first instance of Western jazz engaging with Eastern instrumentation, there was still little like it in jazz music up to that point in time. It's an audacious fusion of tambura with harp, two instruments whose histories on two separate continents reach back to 2500 BCE, yet rarely, if ever, met. As Alice explained, the harp sound is flowing, oceanic, and earthral. It has a celestial sound that people often associate with heaven. For me, the older instruments have more of a mystical sound, and tamburas, hand cymbals, and murugi drums were made for worship. In fact, it played devotionally. All instruments could be used to honor the Lord. The Impulse team knew they had something different, and a promo sleeve was designed like a doctor's pharmaceutical script pad. Instead of taking a red or blue pill to relax, tonight take Alice Coltrane and journey to Sadikchanda. It's smooth but contains a recommended amount of pure energy. It read, signed by a Dr. I am peaceful. It's silly. But even if they couldn't quite pinpoint what journey in Sandukya was, they knew it was something unheard before. While there was a serenity about it, Alice's music remained every bit as political and radical as the more vivacious shrieks to be heard elsewhere in free jazz. As McBee explained, we were critical of the limits that were being placed on us, and we felt that our musical words could penetrate steel walls, so long as we said them with honesty and perseverance and creativity from the deepest part of ourselves. So we were political in that way. Every bit as radical as the unspoken politics in the music, Alice decidedly broke from the Baptist faith of her childhood. She could no longer accept the restrictions of her upbringing, especially when it came to death and reincarnation. It's a shift reflective of what was happening across the young culture as more and more kids of the new generation began to integrate Christianity. As she put it, the Western Church has failed, especially with young people. It was set up to serve needs. It's not meeting. Ask a Swami Hindu monk or someone else from the East about life after death, and you'll get answers that are real about direct experience, about looking to God. It has helped me to go on. Now, a passing to note, Steve Cropper, and this is titled The Soul Brother. Friends and admirers say farewell to Stax Records' six-string polymath Steve Cropper, who left us on December the 3rd. In August 1967, Steve Cropper was at Stax Studio in Memphis one night, mixing a track, when Isaac Hayes burst in. He said, "David Porter, and I've just written something I think might be a hit." Cropper told me in 2023, "But we need an intro. Can you help?" Telecaster in hand, Cropper listened to their song and immediately started playing the now famous double string lick that starts Soul Man. Later, using a Zippo lighter as a slide, he tossed in a few more memorable parts. "I didn't ask for a songwriting credit," Cropper said. And here's a little bit of that song, Soul Man. His prolific talents put him at the center of such classics as In the Midnight Hour, Knock on Wood, and Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. "I called him the utility man," says Stax artist William Bell. Stax co-founder Jim Stewart needed someone to fill all those roles, and Steve was eager to learn the whole ball of wax: songwriting, recording, production. "For all those hats he so elegantly wore, he was largely invisible," says ZZ Top's Billy Gibbons, "but yet so successful at everything." Born October 21, 1941, in Dora, Missouri, Steve Lee Cropper was the only child of a rail worker father and schoolteacher mother. After the family moved to Memphis in the 1950s, he started tuning into everything from the Grand Ole Opry to Lightning Hopkins, and got his first guitar at 14, when he was awed by Chet Atkins and B.B. King. It was Loman Pauling of the Five Royals who inspired him most. His style of creating rhythm with hot licks here and there became the formula for my playing, Cropper told me. At 16, he had his first song recorded, Flea Circus, by Billy Justice. "When I got my first royalty check for $30, I said, 'Man, this is what I want to do,'" he said. Still in high school, Cropper landed a job at Satellite Records, part of an indie label and studio started by siblings Jim Stewart and Excel Axton. Their combined surnames made Stax. "The shop doubled as a research library," said Cropper. With Axton's encouragement, Cropper's band, the Royal Spades, renamed the Marquees, recorded Last Night, a bopping instrumental that went nationwide. But Cropper quickly realized that touring wasn't for him. "It drove me nuts. I quit and went right to work in the studio." For the next 10 years, the studio at 926 East McLemore was Cropper's home and creative playground. As Stewart's trusted wingman, he worked with everyone: Carla Thomas, Otis Redding, William Bell. Steve's strength as a songwriter was structure, for melody and chords, says Bell, and he also had a great energy about him, just a fun guy to be around. Cropper's signature rhythm meets lead guitar style was born out of necessity, he said. "When you can only afford one guy and there were no overdubs, my job was to be two guys at one time." Steve had a way of establishing very distinctive riffs and complementing the vocal, said E Street Band guitarist Steve Van Zandt, who shared stages with Cropper. It's all about the song for Steve. You can hear elements of him in Keith Richards and George Harrison. Everybody was learning from him. He didn't overplay, he didn't underplay, adds Bell. He could listen to an arrangement, figure out the perfect way to embellish it. In 1962, waiting for a non-show singer, Cropper and the Stax House Band, with Booker T, a Jones on organ, and Al Jackson Jr. on drums, recorded a spontaneous jam. On playback, they dubbed it Green Onions. An international hit, it launched a 13-album run for the Black and White Quartet. The historical importance of Booker T and the MGs being that biracial thing was just radical at the time, especially coming from Memphis, says Van Zandt. It was such a reflection of the label itself. Inside Stax, we didn't care about color, gender, none of that, says Bell. Here's a little bit of the song Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs. Family. A family that worked around the clock, Cropper said. We had 17 artists on the roster, and we'd be cutting 3 songs a day, 6 days a week, 16 hours a day. The frantic pace had one purpose, to get a hit record. But by the time a hit was on the radio, they'd already cut another 100 songs. We never really stopped to enjoy the excitement of having those hit records, he lamented. In 1970, frustrated with how Stax was becoming more corporate under new honcho Al Bell, Cropper departed, hitting the free market. Rod Stewart, John Lennon, even Big Star came calling. That's Cropper on 1974's Femme Fatale. He left his imprint on every track. Steve's playing was the essence of less is more, says Richie Furey, who hired Cropper for his 1976 solo album. He had a great sense of feel to drive a song. Then he'd throw in that special figure that made you smile. In 1978, John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd parlayed a Saturday Night Live sketch into the phenomenon of the Blues Brothers, drafting Cropper, who they nicknamed the Colonel, to lead a band of New York studio cats and Juilliard-trained players. In rehearsals, first impressions of the guitarist weren't favorable. Steve plays by ear, doesn't even read music, recalls saxophonist Blue, Lou, Marnie. I thought, what's all the fuss about? A few days in, Marini changed his mind. He was like a motor man. His energy and clarity was the heart of the rhythm section. Maroney and Cropper became friends, touring the world with the Blues Brothers up until the guitarist retired from the road in 2019. Cropp was an enjoyer, Maroney says. He loved playing. There was never a night when he wasn't killing it. Meanwhile, settling in Nashville in 1988, Cropper made albums on his own with Felix Cavalieri and became a treasured part of Music City's studio scene, recording with Dolly Parton, Jimmy Buffett, and others. In 1992, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And in 1996, Mojo voted him the number two greatest guitarist behind Jimi Hendrix. In 2024, he released his final solo album, the Grammy-nominated Friendly Town, with guest spots from Brian May and Billy Gibbons. Reflecting on his friend's life, Gibbons says, with Steve, what he did wasn't about self-importance or ego. He did what he did for everybody. Steve's sound was original, says Bell, who stayed close with Cropper and spoke to him just a week before he passed. It was a combination of his hands, how he voiced the chords, and his sense of where to play. When I asked Cropper in 2023 how he viewed his career, he said, "Any success I've had as a session man is because I really listen. My main purpose is to listen to who's singing and compliment what they're doing. It's that simple." Here's a couple of Steve Cropper's best songs, and here's one of them by Eddie Floyd, Knock on Wood. Another song that Steve Cropper was part of with Wilson Pickett, 99 and a half won't do. Another song that Steve Cropper was part of, Who's Making Love by Johnny Taylor. All you fellas, gather around me and let me give you some good advice. What I'm gonna ask you now, you'd better think about it twice. While you're lying, cheating on your woman, one more song I'm guessing you're familiar with, Otis Redding's Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay.
Sittin' in the morning sun, I'll be sittin' when the evening comes. watching the ships roll in, and then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay.
And now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Ray of Light by Madonna, 1998. Twinkling atop Billboard's chart in the summer of Madonna's birth, 1958, was Little Star by the Elegants. 40 years later, a song of the same name celebrated Madonna's daughter, Lourdes, key to her creative rebirth. Work began in 1997 with Babyface, her collaborator on 1994's Bedtime Stories. But she turned instead to songwriter Rick Knowles, techno whiz kid William Orbit, and Like a Prayer producer Pat Leonard. The album celebrates love over fame, most explicitly on Drowned, World, Substitute for Love. Madonna's tranquility was inspired by both Lourdes and her commitment to the Kabbalah faith, hence the omission in most territories of the excellent has to be, owing to Madonna's insistence on a lucky 13 tracks. Here's part of the song Drowned World, Substitute for Love by Madonna. Selection of sources is Plundered. The storming title song is based on the obscure Saffron by Curtis and Muldoon. Sky Fits Heaven features uncredited lines by poet Max Blagg. Candy Perfume Girl is co-written by Prince's ex-girlfriend Susanna Melvin. Shanti Ashtrani is sung in Sanskrit, and Drowned World reinvents Why I Follow the Tigers by the San Sebastian Strings. It follows the plot line of Tigers, said writer Rod McEwen, which is why Anita Kerr and I receive co-author credit on the song and not merely sampling mention. Here's a little bit of the song Candy Perfume Girl by Madonna from her album Ray of Light.
Blue-ish window seat. perfume girl.
The variety is made cohesive by the production's electronic ebb, not unlike Massive Attack, with whom Madonna had covered Marvin Gaye's I Want You, and the quality of Madonna's voice strengthened by her work on 1996's Evita. Here's a little bit of the song Shanti Ashatangi by Madonna.
Vande Guru Nam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bote Nishreyase Jangalikaya Mane Samsara Hala Hala Moha Shantiye Hala Hala Avahu Puru Shankaram Shankra Chakrasi Avahu Puru Shankaram Shankra Chakrasi Taharinam.
The album remains today a rich, rewarding lesson. And once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. It's the Mojo interview with Red Hot Chili Peppers bass player Flea. Then the rise of the Hold Steady. And a classic album review of Under the Table and Dreaming by the Dave Matthews Band. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.